Cornerstone's Big Book Study at 7 o'clock on Saturday night, so if you guys ever want to come visit, take a moment.
So, I always like to start out with that I do come from a long line of alcoholics. There has been times where I question that about myself. I am doing myself a disservice if I think that I'm not. My mom's whole side is a bunch of alcoholics, Native Canadian, the whole firewater thing, and my dad's whole side are a bunch of drunk rednecks from Alabama. You know what I'm saying? Great thing. Michigan and Alabama, great mixture there. The reason I even knew to come to these rooms was I actually attended my first AA meeting at the age of 10, not for me, but for my mother. I'll get into this a little bit later, but she, before she passed, had 17 years. And she would do things. Well, there's a joke we have that when I come to meetings or go anywhere to set up, we arrive on bend time. And then if I'm late, then we're still early because I'll show up to an 8 o'clock meeting at 5 o'clock. To set up. My mom did that. I grew up in the rooms of Easy Does It over in Norfolk. I remember her dragging me and my young sister there to clean out ashtrays, wash coffee cups, and set up meetings. This is when they were still smoking, and that's where I learned at a young age that nicotine stain yellow is a real thing after watching them paint the walls white in the Easy Does It Center. I grew up in that room, and had many a lecture in the main office there, right in the front when you walk in. So, luckily enough, I got to grow up around that and kind of see what this had to offer at an early age. Also, just to let you guys know, I'm not going to mention a lot about it, but there are drugs in my story. They will be mentioned just because it is a significant part of why I ended up here. Being that my mom was in, I ended up in Alateen, did service in that, chaired a conference, learned all about that, ended up in Al-Anon for a while. Had the steps memorized by 15, did not know or understand them completely, did a little bit, but it was enough for me to know kind of what to do once I got here. So I think when I really started getting involved with anything, I smoked pot and drank for the first time at the age of 12. That kind of started the whole thing of me wanting to get out of my head. What I did learn early on is that, alcoholism is not, it's not about the alcohol, right? Or any kind of addiction. It's about us having a life and self problem. And tracing it back to when I think I figured that out was when my mom was in the Navy, we lived in Spain. So what I knew was being in a place that was a mix full of people, right? Didn't know what racism was, didn't know anything about anything like that. So we moved back here, and I think the first time I realized that I had a problem with myself was going to a predominantly African-American school and riding the bus and a young black child telling me he didn't like me because I was white and because his parents told him not to like white people. At that point, I was confused because my parents always told me to love everybody, that being their backgrounds, where they grew up, and told me to hug people instead of shake hands. That made it very awkward for me as a teenager, but you live and you learn. They explained the whole idea of racism, and from that point forward, I think it turned me into the empath I end up becoming today, wanting to just show everyone love. Now, obviously, there was a point in my life where that wasn't a thing, and I was a total giant tool, but, we'll get there. Going from there, I'm going to bounce around a lot, and I'm probably going to pull some stuff out of here and read a little bit, because that's just how my ADD brain works, but we'll get there. When I was 15, I turned to a giant pothead, there's one time, it was October 2000, Halloween 2005. I remember we had been drinking a little bit, smoking a little bit of pot all day. We ran out and this kid we were hanging out with stole some Adderall from these friends of ours. And at the time, the highest milligram and dose that you could get was time release 25 XRs, 26 milligram XRs, something like that. I thought it was a good idea to take six of them and parachute them. If you guys don't know what that is, you take a Kleenex, dump all the stuff out of the capsules in, and I took them all at one time. I then learned that you can be conscious and overdose, and I was up for a whole week. After talking to my mom consistently and telling her this and all my secrets and all the things I've been doing, like smoking pot with my dad, all these good things, she was like, "Do you think you need to go to the hospital?" I was like, "No, I don't need to go." 2 hours later, I'm like, "Yeah, I think I need to go to the hospital." From that point forward, up until I was 32, I had been trying to on and off again get sober. I remember shortly after that going to a NA meeting with a friend of mine who was on probation that meets on Wednesday nights over at Candlelight, where Candlelight happens. And I did that for probably about a month and didn't pay attention to nothing, you know what I mean? Just went because I thought that's what I was supposed to do. Obviously, that then proceeded, you know, stopped doing that, and it wasn't very long before I started, like, actually really getting into drinking. I think I've always drank alcoholically a little bit, but because of knowing my mom and knowing what she did, I had, like, a... I think the universe set me up to try to be very careful. Not that I did, but I had an idea that I could become an alcoholic, right? I already got the seeds planted for that to start happening, as of whatever I told you. Let's go a little bit further. Like, the first time I did my real big speaking was at Jay Walker's, and I unironically saying I don't remember most of my blackouts, because I didn't. I meant to say that because I didn't really have a lot. I had a lot more brownouts than I did blackouts. But one significant one that I remember coming out of, and it was one of the moments early on that I learned that there was probably some deep down anger inside of me that I didn't know I had until it started to manifest later on in life. But was I remember me and my buddies, we were hanging out at Neptune Festival. His dad had worked for SB Ballard, and they gave him a free hotel room. And so we went out there, and we, you know, had a big house party before for our homecoming at his house. His parents found out. For some reason, they still let us do it. And we're just continuing the drunken shenanigans into the beach. We ended up, like, going and, like, drinking all day, stealing stuff from stores. We ended up with a 24-pack, like, buried in the beach. And by the end of the night, after, like, raiding a bunch of, like, vendor carts and stuff, we ended up underneath one of the docks on the oceanfront. And I don't know exactly how this happened. I remember coming out of a blackout with my best friend, who I live with now, surprisingly, we're still friends, with my hands around his throat, and I was choking him. And when I came out of it, he was gasping for air, and I let go, and it freaked me out. I actually can remember crying over this because I didn't realize what I had done. And he was like, "Why'd you do that?" And I just remember looking at him being very scared and saying, "I don't know." So obviously, you know, more signs, right? Let's see. I'm going to fast forward a little bit because there's a lot of stuff. Actually, yeah, no. So in my attempts to get sober, there's probably three times where I tried doing it on my own. A 3-month attempt, and, you know, it was always some kind of something going on at the time, where I had something to keep me going. I stayed busy, but the entire time I thought about drinking. So there's a 3-month attempt and a 6-month attempt, and I was doing really well during all those times. And I remember, like, living with my ex-wife before we were married and taking care of all the bills while she was, like, trying to go through school and making sure everything was taken care of. But leading up into one of those, I moved in with my mom. We moved in with my mom in a moment when I wasn't able to work as much because one of the jobs I had went defunct. So we left our apartment, moved in with her, and that led up to us ending up finding out that my mother had cancer. And I was full-blown into drinking, like, at this point. Like, I was definitely an alcoholic at this point. If I wasn't before, I definitely was because of the way I was drinking. And I was living with my mom, and she was letting me. She knew I was an alcoholic. She had hinted it at me, but not directly told me, just like how we're not supposed to, right? She just kind of would give little hints like, "Hey, you think you're ready to come hang out?" And say little things like that. And I was like, "Nah, I'm good. I think I got this. I watched you." You know, that's not the truth at all, how that works. But so I think it was God putting me in a place of being where I needed to be, because my mom did give me a little more hints at 12-step stuff when we would talk a lot, and I never realized it. She ended up passing away. She had cancer. By the time they found it, it was, like, way too far gone. We don't know exactly where it started, but where it ended up was being in her breasts, her lungs, her liver, her bones, and her brain. So by the time we found out, it was, like, way too late. There was nothing that was going to happen to save her. We found out in March. She was gone by June 14th of 2018. Now, I I always look at that moment as a curse and a blessing, because it was a curse because I lost my mom. You know what I mean? She is the reason for everything in my life, because she stepped up when my dad was not really that great, my stepfather was not that great, and she was the one person that like was my rock for everything. Now that I'm sitting here thinking about it, there's still a lot more about that I need to process that I thought I got through. But yeah, so she ended up passing away June 14th, 2018. Leading up to a lot of things, there was a lot of stuff that happened in my life where I never got to sit down and properly process that. But it was a curse and a blessing, and the fact that it was a curse, I lost the one person that was the most important to me in my entire life. But it was a blessing, because if I hadn't had the things that happened afterward, I would not be here to be talking to you right now, right? Going forward from that, when all this was happening, the relationship I had with my girlfriend, who ended up being my wife, was just getting worse and worse. She felt like because she was making more money, we needed to move to Newport News because she was working in Williamsburg. We moved right as my mom was going through this. So I'm trying to deal with this and worry about a move and worry about paying the bills, because I was the predominant person paying the bills at the moment. And I'm drinking between all of this, right? And then we finally get moved, and my mom ends up passing away. And then for a little while, I remember we went through her belongings, and I found these pain pills. I think they might have Percocets or Vicodin that they gave her for the pain. And this is really what makes me look at my mom as like a role model for this stuff, because even when she was going through all that, she did not take any of her pain medicine. All of it. The same. I remember counting it out, because I happen to like opioids also. you know, and she just stuck with Tylenol and Motrin, the big Navy, big like horse tranquilizer size Motrin, you know what I'm saying, they give you. And yeah, she didn't. We even found some edibles that I remember getting for her that was like, here, you know what I'm saying, like, I know you're sober, but these can help because it helps with cancer, you know. No, she didn't take them. I took them, but she didn't take them. But that proceeded when I was working in Chesapeake at the time. And this is another, like, a miracle of why I think I'm surprised that I'm here, that my higher power obviously had another reason for me to stay alive. For about 3 months after finding that, I would continually drink, take pills in the morning, drive to work through the HRPT, which I'm so surprised, it's a miracle I did not kill anybody. Take more pills in the middle of the day, drink and take more pills on the way back. This is a 3 month period where I was doing this every single day. And, yeah, man, there's a lot of nodding off at the wheel, a lot of, like, near misses, but somehow I made it through it. And then, yeah, as time went on from there, like, you know, the loss of her, like, having to try to be there as best as I can for my sister, you know, because she'd never lived out of the house. She'd always been with my mom. And I was no good for her at all. She had to take care of most of everything. The only thing that I was able to do was provide money we got from my mom passing away to help out with bills for the house for a while she was still staying there until she moved to go to school in Radford. I'm still kind of trying to make up for that a little bit, because I was not the best brother I could have been at that time. And slowly, you know, my relationship with my ex-wife just gets worse. We do manage to buy a car, buy a house, move to Williamsburg, and we get through COVID. There's all these different things. Our relationship gets worse. We start turning into two different people. Let's see, where am I at? Oh, cool. Within all this time, right? Like, I'm still like, I get to a point eventually where, like, you know, I'm so raw from life, and just my drinking's getting so much worse. I'm just like, that I just can't handle it anymore. That, you know, I had gotten to a point where I was just so angry, man. Like, I was getting in a real dark place. I was so angry at, like, the people that took my mom, you know, or that the people that used to harm, like, the two people. I got to a point where, okay, I'm starting to jumble up. This is where I get mixed up. When I'm drinking, I'm suicidal and homicidal. That's two big things that I know about myself. And the reason for that is when I was in the middle of drinking, there's two people I want to take out, right? My dad and my stepfather. My dad was in Alabama, so, you know, one night in a brownout state, I think it's a good idea to go try to find my stepfather. I knew he was in Norfolk. I had an idea of the area he was in, but I did not know exactly where I was at. And so I drunkenly, it was weird, right? Because, like, we had a little chihuahua. Whenever I would get up to go to the bathroom, the dog would bark. This night, though, like, after maybe being asleep for 30 minutes, my ex-wife being, you know, sound asleep, the dog did not bark. I get up, I pack a couple things up, like a saw and, like, a hammer, some pliers, some duct tape. Like, it was about to get real Dexter on him, let's put it like that. If you've ever seen that show and see what he does, that's exactly what was going to happen, maybe a little more gruesome. And, you know, so I go, and this is what I can't remember. I either drove out of the driveway to the apartment complex we lived in, or I got on the highway, right? And something, and I always call this a higher power moment, something popped in my head and said, turn around. And I'm also glad that happened, because I know the rage I had in my heart at that time. If I had gone over to Norfolk, I probably wouldn't have found him, and someone would have got it, and I would not be here right now. And it was going to be very, very, very bad. That was the plan, at least. Also, with that being where I was, I was not liking life. I was waking up hoping that if, like, I got hit by a car, I'd be happy, right? This is where I was. I was raw. I just hated everything. I was not finding any, like, compassion or love out of life. I just did not want to be alive anymore. My plan with that, and I always like to kind of go into little details about this just to convey how raw and how terrible it could be when we're in the cups, when we're really going through it. I had this, and how delusional my thinking was, I had this bright idea that I was working a job, it was a decent job, had good insurance, and I was like, you know, I'm running through all my savings right now, right? I'm running through, and I ran through $140,000 within 4 years. I know for some people, they run through that quicker when they're the kind of people that we are. This is that whole thing of trying to be careful, even though I didn't want to be careful. So my thought was, all right, if I'm going to do this, I need to figure out how to go and leave something for my ex-wife, or wife at the time, and my sister. So I started looking into different kind of poisons that you can take that don't show up on tests for anything, right? Because obviously if you go kill yourself, you know what I mean, like, the insurance ain't going to pay out, you know what I mean, especially within a certain amount of time. So this is my bright idea, and it probably wouldn't have worked, but this is my bright idea, was to go and find some kind of poison that would be undetectable. I was going to put it in a syringe, and I was going to get in my car, and I was going to start driving as fast as I could, push the plunger on the syringe and run into a tree, right, or just some kind of ditch or something like that. So it would be all mangled, and maybe hopefully my body would look all messed up, and then I'd be dead and the insurance would pay out. But my way to let people know, the people I know that I cared about, know that I did this because of where I was at, I was going to leave suicide notes. But this is where it gets funny, is I was going to set them out in binary code, ones and zeros, and leave a timestamp from a movie that explains how to decrypt this stuff. Yes, that's where I was. And I started to write these notes and started to put them into binary code. That's where I was. Let's see. And just to drive home also, the way I was treating my ex-wife right before I had decided to get sober, or I was sober but not, like, really living sober, because I quit drinking. I had a 9-month stint. The details of me quitting drinking are not important. I got really trashed. My wife yelled at me. We argued. I cried. And I was like, all right, I'm done. I had 9 months of dry time, and I was still suicidal. The homicidal was going away a little bit, surprisingly. But I was still suicidal. And I can remember, like, just arguing with my ex-wife. I don't even remember what we were arguing about. But I remember just finally revealing to her, like, you know, like, telling her I was suicidal, right? I was telling her all this stuff, and this is how bad I treated her, right? And how much I gaslit her and was making her feel traumatized for the things I was doing. She didn't believe me. She thought I was trying to say it to win the argument. You know how bad you have to treat somebody for them when you're really being really genuine about how you're feeling and for them to not believe you whatsoever. I'll get into more of that, of why I carry myself a certain way now because of that, but knowing what I did to her, right, and how much, because she doesn't have a 12-step program like we do, that she will have to try to grow from that and go for that, like get better from that, is crazy. That I made her feel so terrible that she didn't believe me when I really wanted to kill myself. And she didn't even know the detail, the extent of the things I wanted to do to kill myself, right? And it's crazy, is I still kind of keep in contact with her from time to time, and I can still see there's still the effects of, like, the things I've done. You know what I mean? So, let's move on. So basically what happened from there is not too long after that, 9 months dry, the car gets repoed. I still have that car, luckily. And it's beautifully 2 years into sobriety, I paid it off. Miracles, you know, nice that promise is happening. I still have that car. It got repoed. I had to finally tell her, like, hey, the insurance money that we had from my mom and our savings that we've been putting away, it's gone. And at that point, she had told me, she was like, yeah, what? And she freaked out, and a lot of yelling, and she called her parents, and she was like, yeah, I'm done. I need you to move out. You know, before all these things, I just mentioned me realizing how bad I treated her set in, which happened weeks later. I was like, okay, what do I do? I went for like a week of trying to do small things to figure out how to save her or what I could do for myself. And I had been, you know, the obsession of drinking was there, but I hadn't acted on it. And after about 3 days, I was sitting there, I was like, you know, I gotta do something about this. I think it's time to do what I saw my mom do. And I was like, I think it's time to go to a meeting. So this is where it gets fun. I went to, if you guys, I don't know if anybody's ever frequented meetings up in Williamsburg, but they have a sobriety clubhouse there called Triangle Stepping Stones. I just looked up, I didn't even know about the meeting app. I just went and looked on the intergroup website and found that, and it was on a Friday night at 8 o'clock. It was a beginner's meeting. And I got there at like 7:20. When I pulled up, I saw a bunch of guys outside of it smoking and drinking coffee. So I was like, oh man, I'm in the right place. And of course I get out and I say to him, like, hey, is this the AA meeting? And the first thing the dude says to me is like, no, we play poker in the back. And I got deathly scared because I was freaking out. Because at that point I was like, man, I need to get to a meeting. I might drink. And then the guy looks at me and he says, nah, man, nah, are you new? And I was like, yeah, I'm new. He was like, all right, well, you know, come on in. Like, I basically said to him, like, you know, my wife wants to divorce me. I don't want to drink. He was like, all right, well, take the cotton out of your ears, put it in your mouth. So I get in there and I'm just being quiet. And this is the funniest thing ever. All the things that they are saying, I'm listening to them. And I'm starting to hear all the life advice my mom had been giving me my entire life. And I was like, there it is, right there. My mom had been setting me up and telling me these things to try to let me know that if I ever needed this, I have a place to go. And then it also made me get a little bit of an ego a little bit, because I was like, oh, Al-Anon, I know a little bit about the steps. I have since found out that, yes, knowing some of that stuff has helped with the knowledge I have now and the way I carry myself. But at that time, you know, that was the ego running in me being like, yeah, I know what I'm doing. And no, not at all. But yeah, so I get there. There ended up being another meeting afterward. It was a young people's meeting, and that's where I got introduced to YPOD, which I'll get into more of that a little bit later. But it was good, right? The first meeting I was at, the beginner's meeting, I grabbed a white chip because I had 9 months, but I didn't know if like that was appropriate. And then I talked to a guy afterward, and this dude made me really happy. I started to tear up a little bit when he did this. he talked to me after the meeting, and he was like, when's your date, man? I was like, I actually got 9 months. He was like, oh, why'd you get a 9 month chip? I was like, oh, I've never been. I thought I was supposed to get a white chip. He runs in and brings out like 9 chips for me. I still have these chips to this day because they meant so much to me. And that was like a great moment. And of course, during the young people's meeting, I did like what newcomers typically do. I took up 20 minutes and just fucking laid in, said what was going on, you know, and everybody kept telling me, like, oh, yeah, you're not going to get your wife back. And I'm like, but I need to get her back. She's all I have. And like, no, you're not going to get your wife back. It's okay. Just accept it. And I'm not wanting to hear that. But what I luckily did do, though, is within 3 days, I met my first sponsor. And he was, you know, the typical thing, call me every day, meetup we'll read. And that was great. I'm glad that I knew immediately because I remember that. Sponsor work on the steps. That's what I knew from my mom. And so I did that. And what was the other thing with that? And then within, because I was like, I need to nerd out on this. I need to get this. Within the first 2 weeks, I read through the big book, the 12 and 12 and Living Sober. The only one I really understood a lot of what was in there was Living Sober, and then the parts of the big book I could relate to about being an alcoholic, right? Like Bill's story made a lot of sense. More about alcoholism made a lot of sense. And yeah. So within that, I learned about WIPA. I think WIPA is a great thing. There's a lot of people that don't really like it too much, but I feel like it's great for people that are really, really early on and young that don't get that you can still be young and have fun and be sober. I like to call it feral sobriety because it's literally just a weekend of people staying up all night playing board games, youth group like games, and chugging energy drinks. It's a lot of fun. And I got to be involved with a conference, and it was really awesome. I got to be the program chair for Virginia State Conference in 2023. And I was lucky enough that like I'd had prior experience being in doing conferences as a kid with Alateen to kind of understand what came along with this stuff, but I didn't know what a program share was. So when I found out what it was, I got scared and went so over the top with it, getting all the things that there was no moment in the weekend that was not packed with something. And I had a lot of help from people. And we even had, for a state level conference, we had a pre-con event, which you normally don't see for those kind of things. And with the help of a lot of other people, we ended up being able to make it one of the biggest conferences of that specific conference that they'd had in years, which is awesome. We had either over or under 400 attendees. I think two people from Canada showed up, which never happens. And the guy that started in the early 90s, I ended up being told later that when he saw the program, he had said that he was not going to go to another one of these things. He showed up. And during the sobriety countdown, ended up being the oldest guy to give away the big book to the youngest people, which was really awesome. And I don't say that to tap my own horn. It's just, I'm glad that my higher power put me in a position to be able to do something like that, because it's one of the most humbling things I ever got to do. It made me really happy to do that. But, yeah, man. And within all this, you know, I'm working the steps. I have a really funny higher power story, but I'm not going to go into that one, about how I got comfortable saying the word God. Let's just put it like this. I prayed to a cartoon character for about 3 months and said the name of this cartoon character, and then eventually was like, this is really silly. God is everything or nothing. And I don't know what God is. I just know it's working in my life. So I finally got comfortable saying God. Now, early sobriety for me was really hard. Obviously, I was going through the steps. I had my sponsor tell me things like, you know, you're on step six, but, you know, you should start sponsoring people right now. And I was like, what is the logic behind that? Shouldn't you work all the steps? And his logic was, well, the first 100, only 30 days or a few days, and they're sponsoring each other. You might as well. And that scared the living daylights out of me, but I did it anyways. I attempted to look for sponsees. I had a year. That was one of his other things of it, too, but obviously 9 months out, it was dry. By the time I finished the steps, I got my first sponsee and started working with him. And that was a very beautiful thing. I learned the biggest thing I can say from sponsorship, which I think AA has taught me how to grow up and taught me a lot of things, is I learned from sponsorship that I learned how to be a teacher. I learned what it's potentially like to be a father, because of the sacred relationship that is the sponsor-sponsee relationship and the people that are listening to you and hoping that you're helping them save their life. With that, tapping into some of those early sobriety things, a lot of the lessons and things I learned in the growing up I had in early sobriety were struggling to keep a job, working two jobs that didn't pay that much, not knowing where my next meal would come from, having to have people in AA take care of me, and feed me. One particular person that I want to mention, and probably a lot of you know her, I look at her as my AA mom and also a relationship I never had, Liz. Liz from Norfolk, if you guys know her. Very open trans person. Made me learn of that whole a lot we normally wouldn't mix. I never thought I'd be like good friends with an AA or with a trans person, and I look at her as my AA mom. She really, really uplifted me and helped me out. But within that too, you know, a lot of times I didn't know what I was going to eat or where I'd have money to pay bills. And I had people in the rooms help me find jobs. And I think a big one for me is that I lost three significant people in my life and almost lost another. I had two of my favorite uncles die in the same week, and I had a niece almost die in the same week from meningitis. And I can remember that being something that was very hard to deal with, and I had to learn the lesson of getting out of self and trying to be there for those people. I learned that that is the thing, is when we're sort of pity potting and when we're in our most vulnerable states, we take a deep breath, we pray to our higher power and ask for the next right action. And people in a meeting told me, get out of yourself, go help them. And I was able to do that. They were far away, but I kept in contact with those family members a lot to make sure. But the biggest one of that is that first sponsee, he died. I didn't really show a lot about it. I was able to keep a good face up. He died sober. It was in a car accident. He got in a car wreck, and 2 days later, he passed away. I didn't get to go to the funeral because I didn't know his family. I kept trying to get in contact with him. But that was hard because I'd really gotten to know the guy, and he was really trying hard to get sober and stay sober to be a good father for his kids that got taken away from him. And they got moved to Texas when he did not know about it. Like, they just moved, and his ex-wife took his kids. And he did not get to see him before he passed away. It had been a whole year since he'd seen them, and he passed away. And I think I had maybe a good, like, 30-minute moment when I was by myself one night and cried about it. And but let myself feel that, right? That is the beauty of this program, is we get to sit in our feelings and process them and feel all of it and try to reflect on it and see what we can learn from it. I'm going to stop that. I'm going to come back to that in a little bit because I feel like there's some things I want to read, but I think it's very important. But yeah, that was a lot of times the road of sobriety. Let's see. Oh, first spiritual bottom. I decide within the first year to get into a relationship with someone. That's always fun. At that time, I started working a night job. I was not getting to all the meetings that I used to get to, and I learned quickly that two or three meetings a week, or even just one a week, is what you got to learn to survive off of. I've been doing this for about 2 years. I've been through the steps once and was in the middle of working with them with my new and current sponsor. I had to go and deal with that. And for some reason, I thought it was a good idea to almost in a way turn this person to my higher power. Not completely, but it felt like that a little bit. I mean, for God's sakes, I was going over to this person's house and mowing their lawn. This is going to be a little unspiritual, but I did not get any play out of that. That really is like, it was really annoying. It's really annoying. That's not good to say, but I mean, like, you know, you think after 8 months that that may happen. but no, it was a good thing. I think it needed to happen because it made me reflect and realize, like, where I can improve as in treating people. Let's see. After that ended, I didn't realize how down I'd gotten. And I'd really, really, like, gotten down on myself and beat myself up about things with that. When really, looking back on it, it was definitely a two-sided thing. We probably shouldn't have been together. We were not fit for each other. We're still friends now, but it was a good learning experience. It taught me that I tend to like to hold people emotionally hostage. Because as being people we are, we tend to be codependent sometimes. I mean, I was also an Al-Anon, so I fit, you know, all the way around with that. And it didn't take me up. It took me up until recently to understand that I do like to hold people emotionally hostage and actually get to a point where I don't do that anymore to an extent. I'll get more of that in a second though. But where was I? So after that though, I remember like getting back into the steps and really digging deep into them and leaning into a lot of step 11, a lot of step 10. And just really reflecting and realizing where I need to improve. And I then went to CircuitPop, which was a regional conference that brought in at least, I think it was like 1,000 people to the area back in August. And I realized I was missing being of service, right? And I got involved with the state conference again and got involved with that bid committee to try to, after that we formed a bid committee to try to bring another regional conference here called ECPOP. And that was literally like the day the conference was over, the people there on the board that I had friends with, we got together and they were like, yeah, let's do this. And you know, a bunch of people like, you guys are insane. You guys just finished two big conferences in the last 2 years. Like, why are you doing this? I was like, because it's all about the newcomer and showing young people that we can stay sober and that there, you don't have to do the things you're doing anymore and life can be beautiful. And I got heavily involved in that again. But also, something I learned about myself, like really fully learned it, I've learned that me and myself with relationships, I can go get coffee with someone and fall in love. Now, before I proceed into this, I do want to talk about one of my biggest events. So I'm going to jump back to talking about my relationship with my ex-wife. After sitting with her and us, like me going into making amends, it turned into a long conversation that we had needed to have that we never had. There's a lot of crying. We realized that we should have never got married, you know. It was just, we thought we should because we've been together for so long, because we were together for totally 12 or 13 years. And, you know, she had told me she did not realize, like, how bad things had gotten for me. Like, after me telling her a lot of what happened, she did not realize, you know, what I was going through and my not having time to grieve my mom. And it was beautiful because, you know, like, we actually became closer friends because of that. You know what I mean? Like, and I really started to really, like, understand, like, the effects of the things I had done to her after working the steps and going and doing this with her. And just realizing we were two different people. We were growing apart. We wanted different things, right? We were, it's completely even to, like, the kind of people we are with, like, who we project ourselves as, right? Like, the kind of, like, our looks. We just didn't have the same values anymore, and it was time to move on. But the amends that the living amends I still have to this day from that is that I never want to treat anyone, no matter what form of a relationship it is, like that ever again. Because it was terrible. I treated her like dirt. She should not have had to deal with the things she had to deal with. And, yeah, you know? And with that, I've just made a continued focus, the biggest thing of with my, when I interact with people is to try to treat them as best as I can and come to people with nothing but love and try to make sure I do my best to not treat them terribly. I think that's one of the biggest things because I find the more that I'm of service to people and try to treat people correctly, that I am at peace. And I think that's a big thing that a lot of us strive for is peace. So with that, see. All right, here's where I'm probably going to start getting a little compassionate. So when we get to this part, just so you let you guys know, when I get really compassionate about this stuff, my hands start moving. I have different little moves that I have that we make jokes about. Oh, one thing I did want to mention, right? The beautiful thing about this program is that along the way, you make amazing friends. And with this program, I have found family. I have people, I have a sponsor I love to call a father. I call him Pops. He calls me his son. He's the father I never had. I've never had that, and it's a beautiful thing. And I have people in these rooms that I call like little sisters and big sisters and people I have called brothers. And we talked about this, and John didn't do it, so I have to do it. We were sitting down before he was coming to speak here 2 weeks ago, and we were just kind of talking about how we all became friends. And he was like, yeah, man, you know, Tyler said we are so close that, you know, we're all just maybe smart enough that we're three halves of a whole idiot. And I find it to be true. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever seen this, but there's this TV show called Ed, Edd n Eddy, and a guy in Norfolk told us that we're them. And there's a really smart guy, there's a guy that's scheming on everyone, and a really dumb one. And we found out Tyler's a really smart guy, John's the guy that schemes on everyone, and I'm the really dumb one. Who also has one eyebrow. I have a unibrow, it's great. I love it. But anyways, all right, jumping forward with trying to treat everybody as good as possible. So when I had finished with Visky Pa, I was not sure what I was going to do as my next thing, you know, besides sponsoring people and being a service. And I had a guy in the rooms say that, you know, you did a big thing with Visky Pa. You know what I'm saying? Your higher power gave you the ability to do a big thing, and that's going to, you don't know how many people you probably affected there, because we had a lot of new people at that conference, and it was great. A couple of them now I know that are still sober, at least a year or so or more. And he was like, as time goes on, when you grow in this program, you won't notice it, but other people will notice it because they'll see it before you do, and they will let you know. And it will be very enlightening, and you'll be like, wow. But you will, the way this guy described this, you will do things that will affect people and ripple out into other people. And he was like, it's going to be like dropping a pebble in a pond, is the reference he made. And how, like, it kind of, like, the ripples we have from that positivity that affect people in many ways, you don't know how far it will go. I like to say that because I now, the way I carry myself, try to watch the way I speak with people, because I don't know how that's going to affect them. And I don't know if, you know, by me saying something very simple and not that, like, profound within a meeting will send some, you know, help somebody out and make it ripple out to help lots of other people, you know what I mean? But I try my best to help if I can. And so I'm going to talk about something I like called the Purple Sock Story. Is something, you know, that I think is an example of this. So along the ways of me figuring out that depending on how the wind blows, if there's a pretty girl, I will come and follow them and try to talk to them. I found out that my female kryptonite is any woman that has piercings, colored hair, and tattoos. I just like, that's like, come ruin my life. I want you to ruin my life. Like, that's my kryptonite, right? And when I was at Cirque Pot, I met someone late at night, and we talked for a long time, and I remember getting her phone number, and I, like, was sitting there talking to her, and I was like, yeah, so where are you from? She was like, Iowa. I'm like, oh, okay, that's far away, but all right, let's go with it. So within this time, we're getting to know each other. I start future tripping, and I'm like, yeah, I'll come to Iowa and help you raise your three kids, even though you're not divorced. Obviously, it didn't happen. I'm still here. But along the way, we would send each other songs, and I sent her this song called Start Wearing Purple by this gypsy punk band called Gorgo Bordello. And that ended up leading into a conversation about how, you know, when she was married to this guy who was some psycho meth head, neo-Nazi guy, how he would treat her like dirt, right? And he did not like her wearing certain things. And one of the things that she said was a really big deal was one time she was wearing a purple skirt, she was showing her legs, and he told her that she should never wear skirts because they make her legs, she looks, her legs were ugly, and that she looked ugly in purple. And I just sat there and thought, I was like, man, that is terrible. And she was like, the only thing I have left of purple is a pair of socks. And with the style she wore, she said she wore combat boots a lot, right? So I kind of just said to her, I was like, you know, why don't you go and start wearing the socks, like, every now and then, right? Just wear them during the day. When you go to take your boots off at the end of the night, before you take them off, look at your feet. Just kind of take some deep breaths and scrunch your toes together, right? Just do that a couple times every now and then, and maybe it'll make a difference. And then, obviously, time went on. We ended up figuring out, like, the distance. It wasn't going to work, man. I'm not going to go to Iowa where there's snow and cornfields and help her raise her three kids. My higher power is nature-based. Hiking makes me happy. There's no mountains in Iowa, so as far as I know. So, no, I'm not going there. But she did eventually, at some point, text me and say that she was wearing purple again. And that made me really happy to know that, you know, just that little suggestion had made her whole world. Like, she started to gain new confidence. She was wearing skirts again. She wore a purple skirt again, right? She's getting back to these things. And she used to like to post whenever she had any kind of significant small moment in her life on social media. And she had posted a picture of herself wearing this shirt with the lettering being purple. And within this, I like to read what she quoted on that post. So it says this, let me tell you a story. Once upon a time, there was a girl who loved the color purple. She wore it, accessorized it, loved it. Then along came a man who made her feel ugly in purple. So she stopped wearing purple and began to hate it. Then one day someone suggested she start wearing purple again, even if only a small amount. It took her another few months, but alas, she did. Now, again, the reason why I, mentioned that and think that that is very important is because within the things I've told you, we don't know what small things are going to affect somebody. You don't know what thing you're going to say in a meeting, whether it be very insignificant or profound, will affect somebody and decide to make them want to stay, right? So what that always makes me think of is that the little things are important. And what that means for me is the little things is that I feel like everything we do within this organization is important. Even down to the little small things of just greeting people or setting up chairs or making coffee or just when someone is rambling on at a meeting and obviously they're not staying in solution and they're just kumbayaing and you're wanting to sit there and pull your teeth out and be like, get to the point. You're not doing anything that's helping anybody. You don't know when that person's saying that, getting that out will help them and let them vent and maybe say something they've never been able to tell anybody before, or even just saying that they're an alcoholic out loud in a meeting. We don't know if that will help them. But we also don't know if sometimes those ramblings will be that little golden nugget of wisdom that someone needs to hear. And I definitely am a big person of thinking that, like, who are we being the people we are to let our egos run so high that we complain about these people rambling? And I will also say I have to consistently tell myself this because I'm also one of those people, because we're human, we're not perfect. It's about God and not us. We don't run the show, right? So I think it's very important to just say how all the little things matter. Setting up the chairs, letting someone ramble your ear off when you don't want to hear it, making the coffee, all these things matter, even though we may think that they, in the grand scheme of things, may seem insignificant. No, they're not. They all matter. Because if we didn't have that person to come and set up those meetings, to make that coffee, to sit there and talk to someone you probably don't want to talk to, AA probably would not be a thing. That's how the first two started, by talking with each other. When Bob did not want to talk to Bill, but they end up doing it, and now we have this organization that's been around for 90 years. So I like to keep that in mind, that we can deflate our egos. We can sit and listen when people, we may not want to listen to people. But there is also one more thing that I want to get to with that. I'm not going to read out of the Big Book of Thought to, I was going to, but I'm going to read it as Bill sees it. This is something that my sponsor read to me, and I think it's very important. So if you guys, well, you just listen. It's page 21 in Asbel Sees It, and the title is Citizens Again. Each of us in turn, that is the member who gets the most out of the program, spends a very large amount of time on 12-step work in early years. That was my case, and perhaps I should not have stayed sober with less work. However, sooner or later, most of us presented with other obligations to family, friends, and country. As you will remember, the 12-step also refers to practicing these principles on all our affairs. Therefore, I think your choice whether to take a particular 12-step job is to be found in your own conscience. No one else can tell you for certain what you ought to do at a particular time. I just know you are expected at some point to do more than carry the message of AA to other alcoholics. In AA, we aim not only for sobriety, we try to again to become citizens of the world that we rejected, and of the world that once rejected us. This is the ultimate demonstration toward which 12-step work is first, but not the final step. Letter, 1959. So I say that because something that my sponsor loves to drive home to me is that we spend a lot of time in the rooms just sticking with doing service work in the rooms. But if we refer back to our basic text, it says, and I'm gonna butcher the verbiage, but we are to, let's see, look at everyone as God's children, that our code is of love and tolerance, with when you think about that becomes patience, and that we are to treat everyone as a sick friend. We don't have to like everybody, but we have to show them love. With a lot of us, sometimes when we get into our heads and try to run the show sometimes, because we always love to take our will back, we forget these things. And then with that being said, that means that, you know, what I was getting to, the small things count, listening to people ramble, just being there for them, it's important. But a big thing, too, is that I get ran home to me is that we love to spend a lot of time in AA, right? We like to do service work in AA, but we forget that we took from the world and that our meaning is to be of service to everyone, all of God's children, of maximum service as much as we can. So that means spending time trying to help people outside of it, not just volunteering with AA, but also trying to find some kind of form of volunteering out in the world. The reason why he brings us home is he talks about when he got into early sobriety, and he did this himself and also watched other people do it. We go to meetings every night. A lot of us do. He said to me, at some point in your sobriety, you will want to not go to meetings every night. The reason being, at some point, you will be able to go sometime without having to go to a meeting, maybe once a week. We turn the meetings into a bar. You're going to a meeting every night, right? The main reason for a lot of people to go to meetings is to say things to help the newcomer. At some point, we can pick up on things too, but not that we got it, but we know how to work our steps. If we really need a meeting, we get to one. We can keep in contact with people. We can work with our sponsors. If we have families, if we have children, by us spending too much time in the rooms and not being with them, we're being a disservice to them, and we're supposed to be maximum service to everyone around us, right? We can learn to not be able to be there for our families. I'm not in that particular situation right now. All of my family is the people in AA right now, my friends. Like, I have a found family. All my family is far away. But I try to find time if I can, if a friend asks me to help something with something I do. My friend owns a mushroom growing business. Whenever he asks me to come harvest mushrooms while he goes out of town, it takes me about an hour, 45 minutes. I go do it. He always offers to pay me. I say, no, don't worry about it. You helped me out when I was in early sobriety, when I needed a place to stay. You give me money a couple times. Let me help you. Right? With that, also volunteer work. Being of service. The big thing that replaces that we would get from a drink is helping other alcoholics, right? We can also get that by being of service to our fellow man, to try to practice that principle of anonymity and to try to just be us and not say, oh, I'm in recovery. Like, whoopee, look at me. No. I'm just another semi-bald guy, tattooed, going to do a job. I'm nobody special. Tell me what to do. I'll be quiet. And maybe I'll make some friends along the way. And I think the significance, like I said, of him telling me that is to realize we need to always do things that deflate our ego, and so we can learn to treat people correctly and just show up, because we didn't do that a lot. I guess with that, to kind of wrap things up, my sponsor says don't be a dick. Try to help people as much as possible. Now, within doing all these things, I have a beautiful life, a life that I never thought I would have. It's been 3.5 years. I don't want to go back ever. I try to do everything I can and live this program as much as I can to make my mom proud, because seeing what she did, to try to be a better brother, a better son, a better grandson, a better nephew, and to be a good friend all around, and hopefully one day be an amazing father and a good husband. I think I've gotten to a point where I do a very good job at that, to where I don't self-sabotage anymore. I'm able to watch when I'm treating people wrong. I had a job where I'm working in a rehab as a BHT, getting to help other people and getting to talk to them and learn about the clinical side of things, but also include 12-step, because that does play hand in hand. It does help. I'm learning a lot of things I never thought I'd learned before about more mental health, which I'm glad I'm learning. It explains a lot of why I grew up and have some of the things that I have. And I'm learning how to not act out because of the steps and because of these different things, right? But I also get to use the 12-step work to help people. That's the most beautiful thing out of all of it. I get to see newly sober people and watch them continue. There's one of them that is here tonight, and I'm happy that she is here. It's awesome, because this person jumped right into it immediately, and that is so great. I know I'm probably not supposed to say it, but I don't care. It makes me happy when I see people show up that I've seen in the rehab I work at. And also, another guy here who I didn't know was an alumni, he was there before I was there. And that was awesome to see that he's here now. I also have this good friend over here who spoke a couple weeks ago. I watched him graduate college a few weeks ago, and it made me realize how much I miss of having a sense of family and wanting to go far. So now I've decided after this, I'm going to pursue a career in human services, and I want to try to go as far as I can and use that knowledge that I've gained from that to try to help people and be empathetic and just do the best I can to show love. If I haven't learned anything, is that I feel like the meaning of life is to be of service to everyone around me, and that love is the one thing that brings everyone together universally, and I try to do my best to push that throughout the world. Energy transference, woo-woo, mystical, higher power, spiritual stuff. It doesn't matter to me. Pushing love into the world, I think, is the biggest thing, because you get it back tenfold when you do it. Helping other alcoholics keeps me sober. It fills my cup up, but I can't do that unless I'm able to keep... I have to work with other alcoholics and to try to be of service to everyone as much as I can. I feel like I'm really rambling at this point. I've kind of gone... I've skipped around. I've gone through most of the things I think that are important in my story. And the biggest thing I like to just put out there is, like, no matter what, if you're struggling... don't give up hope. The ugly ones count as long as you stay sober. Growth happens with tears and snot, as this is all stuff my sponsor tells me, and it happens in seconds and inches. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done, sometimes today it feels like one of the easiest things, but I do remember that it was a struggle, and I'm glad I made it through. I'm glad I had the universe put things into play, seeing my mom and do the things I've done to get me here. And I hope I never go back. I never, never, ever gonna have to go back or want to go back. And to anyone else, if you're early or you're not, you don't have to do this anymore. Working the steps, finding a sponsor, being of service to others, just working this programming, living it day to day. Like, I do it 24 hours at a time. And I really want to thank you guys for asking me to come out here and let me come talk to you and listen to my ramblings, because I can go on. I don't know if I've gone over or under. Thank you. I'm done with that. I'm Ben.